Election 2011 coverage on Manx Radio, brought to you by PDMS.
Hello, I'm Roger Watterson with another in our series of programmes in which we meet the candidates in the 2011 general election. Today we feature the constituency of Gough, where just two candidates are contesting the one seat in the House of Keys, and for the next hour we shall discuss their political ideals and their policies. They are Nigel Dobson, a restaurateur, a pub landlord, and a member of the Liberal Vannin Party, and Steve Roden, a pharmacist. He has served as Speaker of the House and as Minister in Health and Education before that. But first, a quick trot around the constituency with John Moss.
Our constituency today is Gough, which translates into the Manx as Gough. If we look at the Isle of Man as a mole clambering up out of its burrow, and I rather think we can, then Gough is the little fella's chest. It doesn't so much run as amble, stroll up from outside Onchan to collapse exhausted just outside Ramsey, and that's a lot of ground for candidates to cover, a lot of rural miles. Candidates will need their wellies and possibly GPS to find their way around. It's rumoured the candidates from previous elections have emerged from Mackled years after the event, asking the way to the polling station. King Ori's grave is there in Laxey. Well, it's a grave of two halves, with the Balearic Road running straight through the middle. And there's not just one, but two wheels to admire in Laxey, so you'll find no shortage of spokesmen in the area. Gough was the seat of a giant of Manx politics, Sir Charles Carouche. He won the seat in 1946, the first election after the war, of course, and held it until his elevation as the first president of Tynwald 4 decades later. At his height, Sir Charles dominated the Manx political scene like a behemoth. His popular style was to thump the table where he thought it necessary, no matter who was sitting opposite. He stood chin to chin with the UK when necessary, and that's, argue many voters, what's needed today. Gough used to have 2 seats until 1986. Well, it used to have 3 seats, but went to 2 in 1893 and then to 1. It reflects, though, how important farming used to be to the island and how it was then reflected in the membership of the Keys. It was also the seat of Dr. Edgar Mann, the de facto chief minister before the island had that post. He was then chairman of Executive Council, and he was a favourite to be the first chief minister, but lost his seat. So Gough has a resounding political history. One major conurbation, Laxey, and Lonnon and Mackled are well represented at local authority level, with a great spirit of cooperation evident. Issues? Traffic. The main East Coast route runs through, and when the mountain road is closed for whatever reason, the traffic heads up here. When the Bulgham Bay Road is closed, then traffic heads up Balearic, and that's not popular, as you can understand. In tourism terms, Laxey has the wheel and the tram station, which with the refurb of the Summit restaurant on Snaefell is now a major draw. And then there's the regeneration plans, which have a nice head of steam, thank you. The village square is planned adjacent to the station, and of course the Working Men's Institute has been refurbished, so that was revamped outside the general regeneration plans. Laxey has always been an attractive place to live just outside Douglas, but to build homes you have to go, well, either up the valley or onto the skyline, and that's a point of discussion. And when you build houses, you have to cater for... And Laxey has yet to be included in any Irish sewage works. It's... And forget in Laxey and Bouldraine. Well, not quite forget. In 2014, the situation will be reviewed with regards to the next stage of the Irish strategy between 2016 and 2021. But the development of that infrastructure would be contentious and the MHK would be heavily involved. So let's hear from those who would be that MHK in this rural East Coast constituency.
That was John Moss. Now to the candidates. As is customary at the beginning of all of these programmes, we invite them to talk to us for 2 minutes about any subject of their choice and without interruption. Alphabetical order it is then, as we first go to Nigel Dobson.
Hi, good evening to you. My name's Nigel Dobson. I'm standing on the Liberal Vannin platform. Indeed, I first joined the party when it was formed 5.5 years ago and fought this same seat at that time. 5 years ago, we were saying that we needed to reduce scope and structure of government. Some of that has been done on the structure, little has been done on the scope, and with the resulting economic difficulties created by the VAT grab, the scope of government is even more important now than it was then. I firmly believe that if we vote the same way as we voted last time, we will get the same as we've had last time, and I don't believe that's been good enough for the island. It is time for change, it is time for a different view and a different way, and I believe Liberal Vannin has the wherewithal to supply that way. with the help of our members and the electorate, we hope to see some real change this time round.
Right, that was Nigel Dobson. Now we turn to Steve Roden.
Thank you. This is a critical election for the people of the Isle of Man. At a time of great challenge, all those elected to the House of Keys will have to offer vision, leadership, clear policy and critical judgment on the difficult decisions ahead and be internationally minded. I believe my experience, political priorities and policies can help in that task. I have served as Minister of Education and of Health, and most recently as Speaker of the House of Keys. And in this last role, this has enabled me to build valuable political contacts at Westminster, the devolved parliaments, and at the British Irish Parliamentary Assembly. So what are my priorities for the Isle of Man? Firstly, national wealth creation and full employment for our people while rebalancing the public finances following the UK raid on our VAT sharing. Next, the vigorous defence of our national interests and the Manx way of life against unwelcome outside political pressure and interference, and further, to sustain high quality public services. How do we do that? The Manx flag has three legs. This reminds us that our economic stability and strength relies on three legs, which must stay intact at all costs. The first of these is low, internationally competitive rates of company and personal taxation. Second leg, a statutory budgetary surplus with no external government borrowing. The third leg is building up our reserve funds. Lastly, I wish to strengthen our unique parliament. Tynwald is the institution which defines the Isle of Man and whose legislative independence has made possible our unique fiscal, economic and social environment within the British Isles. Quite simply, if Tynwald did not exist, we would not exist as a nation and we'd be part of the UK like the Isle of Wight or the Isle of Skye.
There we are then. That was Steve Roden. Well, thank you. We've heard from both of our candidates from GOF. Now it's time to look at the current political scene through their eyes. Steve, you would talking then about Tynwald. In fact, you're one of the few candidates that I've seen in their manifesto refer not to all the departments of government, but to the parliament itself. And you say in your manifesto that you want to enhance and promote our unique parliamentary institution which defines the Isle of Man. Well, there's two issues there. First of all, why and how?
As I indicated, through an accident, happy accident of history, Tynwald has continued as a legislatively independent body. Had it not, we would have been absorbed into the United Kingdom, and today we would no doubt send one MP to Westminster and we'd be a much poorer place as a result. It's our legislative independence and the ability to create our own fiscal conditions in the Isle of Man that has enabled us, for example, to build up a space industry, e-commerce, shipping register. You don't hear much about the Isle of Wight aircraft register, for example.
But the parliamentary institution itself, though, that is indeed the benefits of the institution, isn't it? But how would you promote the actual parliamentary institution? It's a difficult concept to sell.
We need to strengthen our institution of Tynwald. We've had many hundreds of years of parliamentary governance. We've not had democracy for particularly long. We need to strengthen the institutions within Tynwald of scrutiny of government, because Tynwald is the place where government is held to account on behalf of the people, and we operate I've had a long-standing system of doing that, but what is relatively new is a system of systematic scrutiny through standing committees, which is coming in this year and will enable us, I believe, to carry out a more effective parliamentary function on behalf of the people of the Isle of Man.
Now, Steve Roden, the Liberal Vannin Party, in so much of its literature and its campaign policies, is not happy with the government, or the existing government of the Isle of Man. But do you support what Steve Roden differences? Are you content with the parliamentary system? And would you and your party support it and promote it?
I think the parliamentary system is very important, and obviously we would support and promote and wish to continue our independence. I think one of the difficulties that we've had in the past is we've been trying to do the same old all the time, and not coming up with contingency plans for when things go wrong. I think we need to look. We've been hit twice by the VAT sharing arrangement. We need to seriously look at the possibility of abrogating from VAT, not necessarily doing so, but actually having a plan in place to cope with that. We need to look at the way our government associates with the UK through and Europe through Protocol 3, and perhaps look at the European Free Trade Association, which the island was a member of for many years before the EC, and still works very well for places like Norway, Switzerland, Denmark and the like, and look at other ways so that we can protect our independence should there be further attacks upon it.
Well, these are, of course, are functions of government and to a degree are functions of Parliament. But I think the question was, because we haven't seen it highlighted in any other manner, first of all, than yours, was about the parliamentary institution. Now, I mean, I think people get very confused, don't they, between the Parliament and the government
about it. There's an assumption that by being elected to Parliament, you become a member of government. Mm. That is not the case. You become a member of an institution which holds government to account, and that is a feature of parliamentary democracy. But the reason I've highlighted Tynwald as an institution is because it is what defines us as a nation and distinguishes us from other small communities in the British Isles. And that is immensely important when we are trying to project a separateness and an independent point of view financially, socially, economically to the rest of the world. And very important when we engage with politicians from across in particular. We have a lot to be proud of in the Isle of Man in having Tynwald. And I can tell you, parliamentary visitors to Tynwald envy our system and the way we do things here.
But our system, like leaving a parliamentary system, sort of moving slightly sideways, our system at the moment doesn't really allow for party politics, does it? I mean, political parties have come and gone. Usually they've torn themselves to bits from the inside out and disappeared over the years. Now, as far as the Liberal Vannan Party is concerned, what do you think that you're going to bring to the system? I mean, it's despite the fact that everybody at election time campaigns on what the other government previous hasn't done, nevertheless, there's a huge amount to be thankful for.
There are good things to be thankful for. Of course, there are. No government does all bad. Indeed, if you look at Peter Carron's voting record over the last 5 years, everybody says he's always the rebel, but he actually votes with about 90% of what government...
I don't think I'd agree with that. That's not my observation.
Well, they're the figures we've worked out in our research. But I think Tynwald is a hugely important institution. Steve's right in saying he's identified as the Isle of Man, but I also think he's in need of reform. Because we're sitting here, we've both got copies of manifestos in front of us, and the chances are that if Steve's re-elected as Speaker, that's a manifesto that's gone into a shredder. If the Liberal Vannan Party
nonsense.
Don't get... it's not absolute nonsense.
The Speaker has a role in Tynwald as a constituency member.
But this is an election for the House of Keys.
Which is a branch of Tynwald.
Which is a branch of Tynwald, and this is an election for the House of Keys. And it needs reform, as does Tynwald. I think you would agree with me that MLCs need to be popularly elected. I think you would agree with me that there should be a way of allowing the Chief Minister, the people, to have a say in who the Chief Minister should be. I think you would agree with me that there needs to be scrutiny, there needs to be openness. And I think you should join the Liberal Vannan Party.
I don't think, to be perfectly frank with you, that a party system is the way forward for the Isle of Man. I think we're too small for political parties.
Well, it's very well in Gibraltar.
It can be socially divisive in Gibraltar. Isn't
they
it?
Have a single constituency in Gibraltar. That's the difference. I think the trouble is with... I'm not against political parties. In fact, I used to be an active member of a political party because they can serve a very important function of bringing together like-minded people sharing a common political philosophy to work out debate, work out policy and present it to the electorate. That's fine. It's when you go beyond that step. I hear many politicians from your party, Nigel, talk about the block vote of the Council of Ministers. Well, the whole essence of a political party is to secure for itself its own block vote. It wishes to have a majority in Parliament and form a government, and worse still, from a parliamentary democracy point of view, it will dominate the scrutiny structures. If there's a majority party in the Isle of Man, it will be disastrous for scrutiny and independent thought.
Let's look at the facts. You'll have to toe the party line
and we will have an elected dictatorship.
Let's have a look at the facts. Liberal Vanin on this occasion are putting up 10 candidates. We can both do the sums. We are not going to be the majority party. I wouldn't be surprised if in future elections, should there be an equivalent of a Conservative and or Labour or Manx Nationalist or whatever parties, that there will be coalitions in the future. At the moment, you've got this system where once the election has taken place, the people have no say in who forms the government. We're voting for an electoral college who will choose a chief minister who will then choose the members, and if the members don't toe the line, he kicks them out, and it'll cost them a good slice of their salary.
Haven't you voted on the strength of when you cast your vote, you've decided that's the person you want to represent you?
Yeah.
Now, he's not a delegate, he's a representative, so don't you have to leave him some discretionary power?
Of course you do. Within Liberal Vanin, we're not a political party in the sense that the Liberal Democrats would be in the UK, where they've got one line, two line and three line whips. We have national policies which we've agreed on, which we believe in, which we campaign on. But on our local issues and areas that are not covered by the general manifesto, we're free to behave as we wish. If we have subjects that are a matter of conscience, we're free to behave exactly as we wish. Just as you were confined when you were in the Council of Ministers.
I don't think, Nigel, you can have the best of both worlds. If you're a political party, your whole ethos is to promote a platform of policy and to work collectively and to be bound by collective responsibility.
I absolutely agree with that.
And that means towing the party line, does it not?
I'm a founder member. I've been with the party since its inception. I've sat on a number of committees. I've been chairman of the central branch. I'm not towing the party line. I'm helping to create the party line in which I believe. I don't think there's anything wrong in that.
Is that rigidly enforceable? I think before we move on off the party issue, I think we have to explore one more point of that. Is that once you're a party member, and if you're a party member of the House in this instance, not just a party candidate, are you obliged to follow the party line, even if it conflicts with your own views?
I think if there's a major issue of conscience or a major issue, then no, you would be allowed to either abstain or vote against.
So what is the contract that all the members of your party seem to have signed?
What we don't want is another Bill Malarkey situation. And what we have said is we will stand on the Liberal Vanin platform. And in the event there'd be an issue or a matter where I felt, I'm sorry, I think Liberal Vanin's wrong, I am going to resign from the party, I will also resign my seat and force a by-election. What I will not do is remain within the House of Keys, having gone in as a Liberal Vanin member, and leave Liberal Vanin. That, I believe, is dishonourable.
So the contract doesn't oblige you to vote the way the party tells
not,
you it's
not going
to?
Not on every single issue. That's the things we would discuss and negotiate as we go
through. What I find somewhat difficult to understand, frankly, Liberal Vanin Party, liberalism would one assume be the common political philosophy.
The party, was that not your original party?
Well, I was a member of the Scottish Liberal Party at one time, but the Liberal Vanin Party is not any Liberal Party I'm familiar with. I know it's a member of Liberal International, but I'm not quite sure that the individual candidates are united by a belief in liberalism. I know there are members of the party and prominent members with or have had close links with UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, which is certainly far from being a liberal party. What seems to unite members and candidates is simply the fact that it is a party and that they want to promote and achieve their own block vote of their own. Now, if it's liberal in nature, good luck to you, but I've yet to identify that.
I think we can spend a little too long on this, can I just give the last word to Nigel, then we move on?
Our manifesto is being published at the end of this week, and I think when you read the manifesto, in fact you can go onto the website liberalvanin.org and have a look at the manifesto, and I think you would agree it's supporting liberalism.
Well, of course, that's a decision that those listening to us today, of course, will have to make.
Indeed.
We're making ourselves here today, but right, well, thank you for that. Now, both of you, in different ways in the manifestos, Nigel, you said that Liberal Fanon will get a grip on international affairs, and you, Steve, said that you think the better management of our relationships with the UK. So you both seem to be agreeing with that, but there's a slight difference. One says get a grip of it, one says management of it. What do you mean by get a grip of it?
I think we probably, if I'm honest, mean similar things. I think what's happened in the past, very much so, and again, this is where I think a party has an advantage, is that government has been reactive rather than proactive. We are reacting to the reciprocal health agreement. Good work was done and the agreement was saved. But had the agreement not been saved, there was no plan B. There was nothing in place to sort of cover our citizens. I know that Steve actually voted for the Liberal Fanon proposal that we put through, and that's what government should be doing. It should be, you know, it should be proactive, not reactive, and we need to be that with our international relations too.
So again, let me explore that a little more. By being proactive, are you suggesting that in times of quiet, where there's nothing actually going on, we should be out there pitching?
Absolutely. In the times of quiet, when there's nothing going on, the current administration and administration of the past have spent too much time doing nothing.
I think we've been very, very good at certain aspects of our external relations. For example, proactive engagement with international tax and regulatory authorities has been very effective and has maintained the island's position at the forefront of reputable global business centres. And that has been done by very skilled officials and at political level. Unfortunately, and I agree with Nigel in this, other direct external challenges to the welfare and the well-being of the people of the Isle of Man have been handled, frankly, with complete political ineptitude. The response by government to the proposed ending by the UK of the reciprocal health agreement, I'm afraid, is a classic example of how not to engage at political level. We had basically rolled over. We did not engage politically, and we accepted the ending as a fait accompli. So I talk about better management of our relationships, and we have to step up political engagement, one-to-one engagement, politician to politician, both with the UK, EU, and other, and diplomatic dialogue with other governments and organisations, making friends and allies across the water, in particular, being on first name terms with them, and thereby enlisting greater political support for the Isle of Man by people who are well disposed to us when it actually matters. And part of building up that better management, I think, should involve exchange secondments between UK and Isle of Man senior civil servants, that they work in each other's jurisdiction to get an understanding of and pick the best and come home with a better understanding of what the other side is all about.
But the practical side of international relationships has always been improved. You can't beat two fellas sitting in a room talking to each other. So, I mean, it just doesn't seem to sort of have happened in the last 5 or 10 years. In the past, in parliaments in the past, in Tynwald, if they wanted to, could speak to the Home Secretary, could speak to the Secretary
of State. I think part of the trouble is we've allowed ourselves to be trapped into conducting relations through the so-called official channels, through the Ministry of Justice. And that works fine in day-to-day liaison and cooperation. But where it falls down is if you don't nurture and create the political relationships to go along with that, minister to minister. A health minister should be able to pick up the phone to a UK Secretary of State for Health or junior minister and get a problem sorted out and not wait 6 months till others have intervened.
I'm sure you wouldn't disagree with that, Nigel, but how would new, inexperienced people going in the House develop the credibility to be able to do that?
I think you have to look at the calibre of people we're putting forward. There's no question that when you first enter a the House of Keys, then there's going to be a learning curve, and it's going to be a fairly steep learning curve. But that's no argument for putting new people into the House of Keys, because otherwise you will get the same lot again, and democracy stops. We have some very high calibre candidates, I believe. They've come from all walks of life. And I think that's what Tynwald should be. It should represent the entire spectrum of the island. It shouldn't all be businessmen, it shouldn't all be accountants. There should be the shopkeeper, there should be the public and restaurateur, there should be the pharmacist, there should be the finance guy. That's what Parliament should be.
Yes, but it's the mix is fine. I mean, I think all parliaments, if you look at the UK or Ireland, they've got a mix of different types of people. That's what makes a parliament probably so effective at times. But it comes down to the actual dealing at the other end. We all know that if you want to deal minister to minister, the senior officials don't like it. And they prefer to do channels. You get a resistance to doing these things.
I think that's where there needs to be a culture change in the relationship between government and the politicians and the senior officials, that the senior officials are there to serve. And if the requirement as government is that these lines of communication are open, they should be readily open, they should be easily accessible, and if there's a change of administration, as happens in just about every democracy in the world at one time or another, then those channels are there on day one. The British Prime Minister, on day one of his term of office, should be able to speak to the American President if he so wishes. And this is creating decent channels, and whether you're new or not, should not affect your ability to talk to the people you need to talk to.
So how do both of you react to the service that have been going on lately, and as a product of some of these surveys, it says that a lot of people, maybe as a consequence of the actions of the past or the results of the past few years, think perhaps now we should indulge in employing a lobbying company and even employing professional negotiators. How do you react to that, Steve?
I welcome the surveys. I think they've done a service to political life in engaging with public opinion. But politicians have a responsibility as well to lead public opinion and not simply react to popular feeling, which is not necessarily informed fully by the facts. And that's of necessity. Politicians find it hard enough to get a grasp of the facts and to make critical judgments on issues. And before we rush into presenting the public with referendums and complex issues, I think we must bear that in mind. If we're talking more effective lobbying and engagement, I think that's just part of what we're talking about generally. We have been very effective, as I said earlier, in the way we have engaged and negotiated at high level with tax authorities and laid a secure foundation for financial business to operate in the Isle of Man.
It does seem, though, that you're taking, if you use, for instance, a company to professional negotiators to do the job for you, you're taking away from your own credibility when you do that.
It depends what you give as the remit. There's no point not having in place your own policy driven by politicians. I think there's always been a terrible danger that political development and promulgation of policy, unfortunately, is left to officials, which is why I do welcome the concept of politicians making policy as an organisation, as a political party.
Yeah, I think that's
a good thing. So giving a lobbying company carte blanche and then hope for the best is simply not good.
Because you find yourself lined up with the tobacco lobby and the toothbrush manufacturers lobby and everything, wouldn't you? You'd be downgraded.
And Westminster, let's not forget, there are hundreds of lobbying organisations in the Palace of Westminster and in Whitehall. We would be just one more. It is no substitute for individual politicians forming personal, direct relationships with counterparts.
Well, I'm going to have to go to a break in a second, but just final word before we do, Nigel, I'm sure you wouldn't disagree with that, would you?
No, I don't. I think, as Steve says, it is the politician's job to create the relationships. It's the politician's job to set policy. It is the officials' jobs to carry out that policy at the behest of the politicians.
And to advise them, of course.
To by all means to advise, but not to instruct.
Right. Well, we're going to take a short commercial break now. Don't go away. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Election 2011 coverage on Manx Radio, brought to you by PDMS.
In today's election programme, we're discussing political matters with the two candidates for the constituency of Garth, Steve Roden and Nigel Dobson. Nigel, earlier on in your introduction, you referred to the Customs and Excise Agreement with the United Kingdom, and you said that your party would start to investigate the possibilities and implications of abrogating it. Now, this has gone on from time to time over some considerable number of years with the same end result. You said you would want to do it now as Plan B. Is it your party's policy, however, to bring Plan B to Plan A as soon as possible?
No, it's not. What we do believe, though, we've had two VAT grabs at the moment so far. Whether there'll be further, we don't know. I haven't actually found anybody who's sensible within the political or financial world that have actually said the UK have been unfair insofar as we perhaps have been on the generous side in their settlements to us in the past. So the numbers, we hope, are now about right. But we have just accepted their numbers rather than, you know, go and battle them, I have to say. But I think it was Anne Crane said recently that if we were going to abrogate, it would take a 10-year run-in. Well, if we don't start that 10-year run-in to investigate what is necessary, to investigate the financial implications, to investigate the differences it would make to our border controls, et cetera, then we're never going to be able to do it. And we're just at the mercy of the UK whenever they want to come along and change this agreement, because they can abrogate it from it in 2 years' notice as well.
It used to be 6 months, of course.
Yes.
I think when we look at such issues, we must be very conscious of the need to maintain business confidence in the way we handle potentially major changes to our fiscal structure.
Are you suggesting that actually doing the investigation would create a lack of confidence?
No. I'm suggesting that the policy that's being advocated in some quarters of a referendum on the subject, which seems to be quite popular as a notion, is actually quite dangerous. I think the Isle of Man has got to be very, very careful when in the way it handles its what has been a very successful fiscal policy. The 0-10 tax regime, for example, without that, the global business that we have here could easily disappear overnight to our competitors, leaving us with mass unemployment, economic slump, collapse of housing, and so on. The way we approach abrogation and the VAT, yes, the loss of government income is very serious and has severely tested our relationship with the UK. But I think we're seriously mistaken if we believe the answer to our recent problems lies in ending the Customs and Excise Agreement, as some are positively suggesting, not just looking at it, but suggesting. Because we have to accept that even with the reduction in the VAT, the agreement, it remains very much weighted in favour of the Isle of Man and is in fact vital for our interests. And this is because...
You say that, but this is the question, isn't it? We hear this quite often, but we've never really had anything of any substance to support that contention, because there are absolutely no figures and the formula is a mystery to everybody but the experts.
Yeah, but I think it's fairly clear, even without detailed figures at our disposal, because it has never been an exact science, the revenue sharing arrangements. Way back to 1959, the original Common Purse, which you remember, they used to have decennial tests to have a stab at calculating how much alcohol duty and tobacco duty was attributable to the Isle of Man. So it's not an exact science, but what we do know is that even with this latest hit, the revenue sharing is such that the Isle of Man gets returned to it at least an element of the VAT spending made by individuals and by businesses in the Isle of Man in the UK economy.
The internet must be a big factor.
And the internet spending is part of it. If we were simply to rely on the VAT collected locally from what is spent within the island, we would still be worse off. Plus, the big downside, and this is why I talk about business confidence, is that all our trade with the UK would then become imports and exports, and this would mean higher administration for businesses, compliance, cash flow costs, because they'd all have to separately register for indirect tax returns and customs. Island residents, when they travelled, would face the possibility of double taxation on purchases in the UK unless they took part in the UK retail exports scheme. Well, Jersey does not have the 200 or 300 manufacturing companies that the Isle of Man has. That's the key difference. We're different economies. Their financial sector is structured differently. Our business benefits by being part of the UK and EU customs area and VAT collection system, and we tamper with it at our peril.
So if
let's make it clear, Liberal Van Ayn are not suggesting that we come out of the VAT agreement tomorrow.
Good.
But for us not to look at a plan B would be as irresponsible as it was for the current administration not to have looked at a plan B during the health agreement situation.
There certainly must always be contingency planning.
There has to be, and you don't get that contingency planning overnight. You've got to start the investigation. It's got to be thorough. It's got to be properly researched. And it's got to be ready to put in place should the need arise.
Has this been done?
We don't set hairs running and disturb business confidence. And
I think business would have much less confidence in an administration that and became reactive again as opposed to proactive.
Do you not find that we often hear these arguments about it's better not to discuss something because we might either damage confidence, or we often hear people saying, well, we're on a good streak, really. We've got a growth still, even though it's not reaching all sectors of the community. We've got low unemployment by comparison to other countries, all the various positives, which I think it'd be churlish not to agree that we have. But you then find, and some of your colleagues frequently, Steve, argue that we, whoever we are, the media, whoever it is, shouldn't be discussing anything else that's not positive because it damages confidence. In other words, we should keep quiet about it.
It's getting the balance right, and the media can report in a responsible manner. That can happen. Doesn't always happen, or not necessarily to the satisfaction of certain political viewpoints, but overall, the media do have a responsibility, which they discharge, I think, more or less the way they should.
But it's not the media's job just to report the good things, is it?
No, it's
not. I don't think it should be the politician's job just to report the good things as well. One of the issues that I have with the way government generally portrays itself, yes, we have low unemployment. We have a growth rate of 5 or 6%. We have recently announced the highest inflation rate for 20 years, 6.7%, I think it is. Mm-hmm. But these figures can be misleading, because if you look at the growth rate, you've got sectors of the industry, of the economy, that are growing in double digits, and we all know that to be true, and that's good for those sectors. But if your average is then 5% and some are in double digits, that means there are other sectors of the economy that are actually either borderline or in recession. Now, if we're not acknowledging that and not giving the help and support to those industries, and catering, retail, a lot of the service industries are in that situation, if we're not being honest about it when we're making our pronouncements, rather than saying, hey, aren't we doing well, 6% growth, actually no, 12% growth in that sector, 2% recession in that sector, that's where resources are needed. And that's what I don't think we
do enough
of.
Well, the essence of good financial and political management is, of course, to look at the bigger picture.
And I don't think we're getting that at the moment with
respect. I don't think we do, and I would also go as far as to say that many politicians must be very careful not to run our country down or talk ourselves into recession or a state of depression, because the bigger picture is that life in the Isle of Man, despite the things Nigel has rightly referred to, is surely measurably better than the world around us. We just need to look at the UK.
Where does this impression come from then? And we do, I mean, I'm sure we've discussed this in the past, that the public do believe that they're not being told everything. In other words, that we're only told the good news and not the rest of it. True or false?
Well, I think public opinion is heavily influenced by the daily diet of bad news that comes from the United Kingdom. And when you see the job figures, the massive redundancies, the social unrest and the national discontent.
We're in the backwash, then, aren't we?
There is there. Exactly. We get the backwash and we forget that here we have we're in a safe place where crime is the lowest for 25 years and with virtually full employment, still have good work opportunities and low rates of personal tax. But none of that is to blur the requirement to be honest in our dealings and in our communication with the public, and when there is not always good news, to communicate it and to be open and transparent, you know, to use those cliched words, but absolutely right.
Well, we were sitting here 5 years ago talking about that.
Much information as can be reasonably released without compromising commercial confidentiality and the national interest. And it's getting that balance right.
Everybody was saying that, Steve, 5 years ago. Just about every candidate, yourself and myself included, yes, talked about openness and transparency. When the government did eventually bring out some form of Freedom of Information Bill, you can have any information you want except for the information we don't want to give you. And that didn't go anywhere either. Waiting for it to happen.
With respect,
more of the same.
Outside commentators have actually looked at the proposed legislation, proposed statute in the Isle of Man, and have also looked at our existing non-statutory code of conduct for the release of government information, and concluded that in some respects it is superior to what they have in the UK. But it is down it will be revived in the new House. It will be the first parliamentary legislative business of the new House in October, and I shall certainly be supporting it, and I'm sure you would if you were in that position.
I would indeed.
There are a number of other issues, of course, that are more practical to people at the moment. When we come down to an election, I often allege that people in the end only vote for what's in it for them. In other words, it's really politics at the end can be quite personal at times. And we hear, as you just said, Steve, about businesses doing well, the growth in the economy. And then we hear a number of young people throughout the island at different levels of the economy too, complaining about how they simply can't get onto the housing ladder. How would the Liberal Venon Party help in that?
We have a couple of ideas that we'd like to investigate with regards to housing. We've long supported a shared equity scheme, which would be in a separate market. At the moment, you've got the private sector, the public sector. We would create a third sector called the shared equity scheme. It would only be available to Manx workers. They would only be able to live in them. They wouldn't be able to rent them, rent them out to anybody else. And when they sold them, they would only be able to sell them to people in a similar situation.
But at the market value?
I think the market value would be lower because the potential for profit isn't quite the same. There would be new builds that we would, where possible, use government land. And there's huge tracts of government land that could be used. We would be supplying part of the equity, so even if it is still a £200,000 house, the individual would only have to find £100,000 because government would be
doing
the same.
But even some may find that a daunting prospect.
Indeed, yes. But I think a £100,000 mortgage over a 25, 30-year period low these days.
The fact of the matter, of course, is that these ideas have been tested in the House of Keys and been found wanting. Have attracted very little support from other members of the House on the grounds that is it really sensible or wise to use taxpayers' money to possibly adversely affect the working of the housing market.
But the only other alternative, because these people have got to be housed, the only other alternative is to go into public housing, and that's using taxpayers' money to create additional subsidised housing.
Yeah.
And I would argue against that.
We have had for some years now, a very successful house purchase assistance scheme, which is the envy of many local authorities in England. The threshold for income was recently raised. Arguably, the value of the property for which the scheme qualifies is not sufficiently realistic of current conditions. So I can agree with you on that. But that is actually a success story. Possibly we should go back to earlier schemes and practices, such as making building plots available for self-build. I know there's a number of individuals who did that in the past, some decades ago. Maybe we need to be looking at that
again.
Because
a lot of this depends on the supply of money, doesn't it? And not just government money, but money coming from the banks. And the main banks of the Isle of Man are telling us at the moment that they're lending more than they've ever lent for a long time, but the market is contracted because all the Irish banks have pulled out of the development element. So there's actually less money available now on much stricter terms than there used to be.
Yes, I mean, the housing market is completely flat. As anybody trying to sell a house will attest, the average house price is not far short of 300,000. It is a very expensive place to live, and of course the age at which young people get onto the property ladder, I'm afraid, is
going up
receding.
And unless we come up with something like the shared equity scheme, or find another way, if that way isn't right, we're in danger that our young people are not going to be able to afford to live on the island, and they're going to move away. And that, in years gone by, people moved away because there was no work. I'd hate people to move away when there's plenty of work but nowhere to live.
Yes.
Now, of course, if you move on, the logical moving on, people's ability to buy a house as opposed to rent or go into public housing depends on their job, depends on their income, and of course, the amount of borrowing that they can take on also depends on their income in various forms of gearing. Now, it is said that the scope and structure of government, who's the biggest single employer in the Isle of Man, quite simply has got too many people on board. Now, if that is your plan, Nigel, to considerably reduce the scope of government of structure, will that not actually cause a negative effect on the balance sheet and put too many people onto unemployment, and therefore have a complete negative effect on how the housing market and everything else?
No, I actually don't think it will. I'm an employer. I've got 50 or 60 people working for me during the summer. And I struggle to get staff. I really do struggle to get staff, and I know many others that struggle to get staff.
Is that because of the industry you're in, though?
No, not indeed. Indeed not. There are other industries with the same skill shortages, and I think government take up a lot of these things. A lot of the scope of government, for instance, should government be running a restaurant on the top of Snae Fell? I don't know whether it should or it shouldn't. But if it's in the private sector, those jobs stay there. Yes, they don't disappear. Should government be running Ronald's Way Airport, or should we be corporatising it and making it work?
So what do you think?
I think there is room, there has to be room to reduce the scope of government, because we can't afford a government of the size it currently is, and that's much more important.
So what are you going to do with the surplus to requirement staff?
I think that will allow businesses and industries within the island the resource to actually expand, where at the moment some don't because they can't get the staff.
Well, number one, we must not disturb our tax policy. That would be fatal. So there's only two other things that you can do. You either cut your coat according to the cloth by bearing down on government spending. That has started through the five-year programme that government started 2 years ago. But more importantly, and what should be getting done anyway, is wealth generation, and it is growing our way out of our economic difficulties and this tax shortfall that will be absolutely key. And Nigel referred to employment in the hospitality industry, for example. It's a fact that we know that half of the very low unemployment, but nonetheless half of it, is in the 16 to 24 year age group. So I would certainly be looking at more skill training programs to prepare local individuals for work within the hospitality and service industries, with greater emphasis on vocational training through Isle of Man College and apprenticeships, so that young people are taken off the unemployment register and put into productive work in the real economy that will generate the wealth that this country needs. But at the same time, we need to be looking at the way we organise our own affairs and the public service. 200 plus posts have been saved over the last 18 months through natural wastage. That will need to continue. But yes, you're right. The government will have to look at the scope of what it does, with not necessarily selling off key state assets, which I'm totally against, but running things in a more commercial manner.
Running things in a corporate manner.
Well, we're coming up towards the end of the programme now. And there's plenty more we could talk about, but time's beaten us. So there's one question which I must ask you both. But the listeners and voters in Garth will be tuned to the radio now to find out why, when the election comes, they should invest their vote in you. Why would you say that, Steve?
Well, this is the fifth time I've faced the electorate in Garth, and they've always done me great honour of allowing me to represent them. I believe now I have considerable years of experience which I can put to the benefit of the constituency and the people of the Isle of Man as a whole, and I hope they will support me on this occasion again.
Right, well, thank you. And Nigel?
As I said at the beginning, I think if you vote the same, you're going to get more of the same, and that, generally speaking, hasn't been good enough. A vote for Liberal Bannon, I believe, is a vote for constructive, proactive government that will is badly needed and will see us through to the future. I also think, in particular in Garth, we need a voice on the floor of the House of Keys, and much as I respect the job Steve's done as Speaker, I don't believe that the Speaker should come from a single-seat constituency, because that voice disappears.
Right, well, there we are. That's our two candidates for Garth, and the sand has nearly run out of our timer. And we're right at the end of this edition in the series of Manx Radio's constituency programmes. Today, we featured the two candidates contesting the one seat for Garth. They were former Speaker and Minister Steve Roden, and restaurateur and pub landlord Liberal Vannin's Nigel Dobson. At the same time tomorrow, Beth Espy will be with Glenn Faber, and I'll be back after that with Malou and Santon. Now, if you'd like to hear all or part of today's programme, it may be found on Manx Radio's special election website in the media section under audio. The producers were Mark Tiley and Catherine Nicol. I'm Roger Watterson. Goodbye.